You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Facebook announced plans to combat fake news yesterday. Find out why the new move is stirring up some controversy.
But first, what do you call a person who hangs out with musicians? A drummer.
Yeah. There's nobody to do a rim shot for that
one. I know. It kind of fell flat.
Because the drummers just, they boycott that.
That's why we need drummers. Well, joking aside, how many famous drummers can you name other than Ringo?
Well, I can name a bunch, but our next guest can name a lot more. He tracks down and interviews his favorite drummers for his own podcast. Joe Wong joins us now. He's the host and producer of The Trap Set. It's a podcast that delves into the lives of drummers. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We grew up in Milwaukee, as I understand it. Joe, how did you first get into drumming?
I was 11 years old, and for some reason, I decided to take drum lessons with a guy that lived a couple blocks away from me named John Ruka, and he actually taught lots of the drummers that came out of Milwaukee in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I had previously played piano and clarinet and violin, but the drum set was what really felt like a vehicle for me as far as meeting other musicians and getting into bands and playing rock music at the time.
Now, having been in bands, I know there are drummer jokes like the one we started off with. There are also saxophonist jokes, I guess, that people target me with. But do you think that drummers get
the
attention?
What's a saxophone joke?
Of course, none popped to my mind having said that. But do you think drummers don't get the respect they deserve?
Probably not. Lots of the time, by design, drummers are in the background. They're kind of the foundation of whatever musical group they're playing in. So they're not the people who the majority of the accolades are heaved upon, usually.
And you just completed your 100th episode of The Trap Set. How did you get started with this? You're interviewing drummers, a lot of famous drummers, actually. How did you get that rolling?
Well, I'm a neurotic person by nature, and I wanted to work through my neuroses with other people that had been successful or unsuccessful in the same line of work as myself. So basically, it was an excuse to figure out how other people navigate through life. And just the fact that both of my guests and myself are drummers is almost incidental, but it allows us a certain familiarity from which we can delve into deeper issues right away.
We'll listen to some of the drumming of these drummers in a bit, but you've interviewed some legendary drummers, some of them, I'm guessing, heroes of yours. Are there any anecdotes or stories that stand out to you?
One of the drummers that I thought, if I could ever meet this guy face to face, it would be incredible, was Bernard Purdy. And Bernard was one of the top studio drummers in New York, especially in the 60s and 70s. He played with everyone from Aretha Franklin to Steely Dan to Nina Simone. And he's quite a character. And he's always on in his public performances, but when I showed up to interview him, he had forgotten that we had it set up, and he answered the door in his bathrobe. I think I had woken him up. but we got into a really deep interview about his life and his family and his childhood and his career. And then once in a while, I would just be looking across the room and see this face that I'd watched on YouTube a million times, and it felt very surreal.
Well, here is Purdy playing the song Funky Donkey. You'd send us a list of clips, suggestions. Here's a listen to that. The drumming go there a little bit. Do you talk technique and the finer points of drumming much, or is it mostly more about kind of the story behind their lives and their music?
It's really the story behind their lives and their music. There are plenty of kind of sources that discuss technique, but our goal when we set out to make this show would be to find the kind of universal appeal in these people's live stories. So that's why my co-producer of the show, who's actually a former Madison resident, Chris Karwowski, came on board. And Chris is not a professional musician. He's actually a comedy writer who wrote for The Onion for 12 years and Adult Swim and stuff like that. And he's really good at kind of picking out the stories that resonate with a larger audience than just drummers or musicians.
So what kind of stories did you hear from Purdy in that deep conversation?
Well, he told me about how his father was killed by his best friend over like a gambling disagreement, and then his father's best friend disappeared and probably killed himself. And how he couldn't afford to take drum lessons when he was a young kid, so he would just sit outside the man who taught lots of the drummers in his area and just listen to other kids getting drum lessons, and that's how he kind of got started. And then he told me about how he went to New York and, you know, after being there for a few years, was so successful that he basically had drum kits stored in all of the major studios and would just go from session to session. And then that system has been outmoded, so he kind of walked me through, you know, how he navigated through the leaner times of the 80s and kind of how his career experienced a resurgence when artists such as Beck started sampling him and then eventually using him on records.
Yeah, that sampling issue for drummers, that's a big one here. And we have, of course, Clyde Stubblefield, who's been on the show, a lot of involvement with WPR. I've heard he's the most heavily sampled drummer ever, mainly from his work with James Brown. And he is not always happy about that. He hasn't always received the acclaim, the respect, and the money. Are drummers, in some cases at least, getting money for their samples?
I think now people are compelled to pay for samples, but usually the drummer doesn't get a piece of that unless the drummer has songwriting credit on the songs. There's a stark contrast between who's getting money and who's not. For example, there's one day that I was in Tennessee, and in the morning I interviewed Howard Grimes, who played on all the great High Records label releases, including all the iconic Al Green songs. Then in the afternoon, I spoke to Fluke Holland, who played with Johnny Cash and also with Carl Perkins, especially on like the Blue Suede Shoes session. And, you know, Howard was getting paid just like a session fee, probably under $100 per session at that time, whereas Fluke got cut in on the songwriting for songs like Blue Suede Shoes and the difference between the income that those guys are receiving now is insane.
I'm talking to Joe Wong. He is host and producer of The Trap Set. It's a podcast about the lives of drummers, 100 episodes in now. Here's another listen to a legendary drummer you got to interview. The track is a Grace Jones track. We'll talk about the drummer in just a minute. And that's Sly Dunbar, half of Sly and Robbie, this amazing, legendary reggae and dub and everything else rhythm section. And you got to interview Sly Dunbar, which is pretty amazing. What did you take out of that conversation?
Well, I was really inspired by his attitude. Sly is another of the most recorded drummers in the world. It's been estimated that he's been used on something like 10,000 recordings. Ranging from, you know, Jamaican legends such as Lee Perry to international stars like Bob Dylan and Serge Gainsbourg. And he still goes to the studio every day and probably works 80 hours a week. And he's somebody who's made a good living, but he just keeps going because that's what he loves to do. And that's the thing that I took away most is his, like, inexhaustible work ethic.
Yeah, there's a wide range of work ethics out there. Have you ever interviewed Ginger Baker? He's had some famously difficult interviews over the years, and he has said, "Yeah, I don't practice. I never have practiced regularly."
Yeah, lots of great artists don't practice in the traditional sense, but you know, somebody like Ginger, I'm sure he practiced at some point, and he put in his he put in his 10,000 hours,
right,
if you want to get Gladwellian about it. So, I feel like somebody like Sly Dunbar, his work ethic comes from a place of joy. And then other people, you know, might not have had such a happy childhood, or they have some sort of chip on their shoulder, and that's why they get so great, is through, you know, this inexhaustible drive to prove themselves to somebody or some part of themselves.
I want to give a quick listen to one more track, a very different one here. This is the band Slayer. This is an isolated drum and bass track from the song Angel of Death. And just metal and speed going there. And that just, the few tracks we played, the incredible variety of approaches to drumming. And it sounds like a variety of approaches to living and being a musician and all the drummers you've talked to, Joe.
That's right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Dave Lombardo is really interesting because he came from Cuba. His family were Cuban immigrants, and they kind of were able to smuggle their kids into the United States through the Catholic Church right around the time of the Revolution. And they came over here. His dad moved the family to Los Angeles and became a butcher inside of a grocery store, never learned a word of English. And Dave credits his Cuban upbringing to his incredibly dense rhythmic style, which
wow,
you can hear in his playing. I mean, it's very, very fast and dense, and I think that it has more in common with folks like Tito Puente than it does with, you know, his other metal contemporaries.
Well, Joe, thanks a lot for joining us. We'll point people toward the Trap Set for a lot more stories, and Joe, thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks. Did you think of a saxophone joke yet?
My co-host had one about a chicken that's been run over on the road. The difference between that and a saxophone is the chicken may have been on its way to a gig. So there you go.
Okay.
A saxophone joke. Thanks to Joe Wong, host and producer of The Trap Set, a podcast that looks at the lives of drummers. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we learn about the wonders of Finnish home cooking on today's edition of Food Friday.
Right now, even with social media and smartphones, some parents are unsure about how to best communicate with their grown children once they're in their late teens or early 20s. Our next guest has ideas about how to make sure the lines of communication stay open for both parents and their out-of-the-nesters.
Lori Zarrell joins us now. She's the family living educator for UW Extension Pierce County. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
Well, Lori, what communication challenges come up when kids leave home for the first time?
Well, one of the biggest challenges is knowing how much to communicate, actually, and how to communicate. You know, when your child is still at home, you've got kind of a routine. You know, you communicate somewhat on a daily face-to-face communication, as well as digitally with today's devices and other ways to communicate. So it's kind of finding that balance between how much communication is enough and how do you want to communicate.
And I suppose parents might feel like, you know, a lot of communication is enough to them, whereas sometimes their children might think something different. A lower amount of communication is what is better for them or what they think feels right. So how do you kind of weigh the difference and get to a happy middle ground?
Yeah, sometimes it's by trial and error, but you have a better chance of making some kind of agreement if you talk about it ahead of time and have clear expectations and a game plan about what you'd like. You know, maybe the parent can talk about what would seem good for them, and the student should be able to tell, you know, I really don't want to hear from you every day. And a parent shouldn't be defensive when they're listening to the wants of their young adult.
How do you start that conversation before it's, you know, not a crucial moment where people are sort of heated about it? How do you get there ahead of time?
Yeah, I think it starts even before, you know, your young adult moves out of the home. You just sit down and have that face-to-face conversation. You know, what would seem appropriate? What kinds of things do you want to hear about? And mostly, like I said, some of it's going to be trial and error. And I've launched three young adult children, and I just made it known that, you know, if I'm bothering you or you don't like something, you're free to tell me. And believe me, a couple of them did.
Yeah, so how did that go over? I mean, this is what you do for a living. You should be pretty good at this, but was it still a little
tense? Yeah, you think so, but it's a little different sometimes when it's your own kids. And, you know, one of mine was fairly tactful and just said, you know, Mom, if you need to know, I'll let you know. That was his way of saying, you know, back off.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, I have another child who just came right out and said, you know, I really don't need to know this, or you don't need to worry about me. So, but then again, like I said, you can't get defensive. You have to, you know, kind of gauge what's going to work. And oftentimes when they first leave the home, you know, the communication kind of ebbs and flows. You've got some storm weather and calmer zones, and you start out kind of with that barrage of calls and texts and emails during those early launching years. But it kind of balances, and those emerging adults, you know, get their bearings and build their new networks, and those communications usually drop off, and that's a good thing.
I mean, I suppose it's easiest if you have open lines of communication where people don't get easily upset or offended early on rather than when they're at that age. So how early should you start really practicing healthy communication and letting the doors be open? Is this something that begins in junior high or younger?
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to say you start when they're infants. but, yeah, in terms of expectations, especially with the new digital media options that are out there, you know, start as soon as you're allowing your child to use them, and talk more beyond just, you know, how would you like to communicate, but it's about digital citizenry and how to be respectful and responsible as communicators as well.
Well, we do have, you know, the era of smartphones is upon us, of technology and social media. How do you think that's changed things?
Yeah, well, I think it's changed things both positively and negatively sometimes. I think back to when, you know, I was growing up, and, I mean, I'm watching the snow outside my window. I mean, if you ended up in a ditch somewhere coming home somewhere at night, I mean, you had to walk to somebody's house to try to get help. So that instant communication option is wonderful when it comes for, you know, a crisis situation or, a real need. But it also can become overbearing if you're a parent that's constantly barraging your child with, I can just see it right today, these parents texting their adult children, be careful on your way home from work today. So, they're young adults. They need to experience some failures, and they shouldn't have their parents, you know, hovering over their every move, even from a distance.
Well, I can also imagine that because communication is instantaneous now with texting, that as a parent, you know, you might fire off a text and maybe you're not doing much. Your child might be busy and they might not get back to you right away. And then you can get that, where are you? Text me. What's going on? Kind of a volley of texts.
Absolutely. And if you have a tendency to over-worry to begin with, it makes it even more unbearable as a parent. But that goes back then to having that conversation about, you know, if I text you and I don't hear back from you, you know, how long should I wait before I worry? And sometimes parents can develop a sort of a second sense about when their grown children need encouragement or whether they just want to be alone to figure things out on their own. But sometimes an unexpected, unexplained silence can be a sign of trouble. So you kind of have to, again, it's all about that balance, understand, you know, what's normal, what do they prefer, and when should I start worrying?
Lori Zierl is with us right now. She's family living educator for UW Extension Pierce County. And we're talking about how parents can optimize the way that they communicate with their college-age children when they leave the nest. And you said there can be a sixth sense that develops for some parents, so they know if things go quiet, that it's maybe time to step in and check on their child. But some parents may not ever develop that. So do you have any hints about how to be sensitive to what's going on, to the dynamics?
Yeah, I think that having a mix of communication pathways, so you're not just always texting or always emailing, if that's the case, but having a personal conversation once in a while to try to gauge, in addition to the kind of no responses, if there might be something else going on.
And what about scheduling a phone call saying, look, I'm not going to bug you, but we need to talk every Sunday at 8 o'clock?
Mm-hmm.
How about that? Is that a good idea?
Yeah, it's a good idea if that's the choice that your young adult chooses. I've got three young adults, and I actually have one of my children who chooses to call me every Sunday night. He's an adult with his own family, and that still works out. It started when he went to college, and it still kind of works out for us. But both of us have the understanding that if he doesn't call or something comes up, that it's nothing to get distressed about.
Do your kids ever worry about you? Does this ever kind of flip around where they say, you know, Mom, I've been trying to get a hold of you, and it's snowing. What's going on?
Yes, it does. And I think that, we have to be cognizant of that, too. It's not just us worrying about them. If there's been a change in a routine around communication or several days have gone by and they haven't heard from you, they can get just as concerned for our health and safety as well. So, that does happen.
Do you think it's at all helpful for parents to have phone numbers, emails for their child's friends so that if there is ever a moment where people are out of contact and it is worrisome that they have somewhere to go? I mean, is there a way to do that without being nosy?
I think you probably could, but it would be something that I would do up front, again, in a conversation and not, calling their friends behind their back and saying, can I just have your phone number just in case? It would be a really purposeful conversation about, is there somebody that you'd want to share a number with me just in case I'm trying to get a hold of you or if you would lose your phone and something happens that I need to get a hold of you. So, no, I don't think that's out of line.
What do you hear from the families that you work with about how often this kind of territory that we're talking about can be negotiated successfully and how often there are kind of some bumps in the road?
Yeah, actually, several years ago, some colleagues and I created a curriculum called the College Transition, and we actually talked quite a bit about communication and, again, having that conversation up front about how you expect to communicate and how it changes over time and how that's okay. Like I said, the more conversations up front and how it eases off. And once you know they're settling comfortably and things are going well, you don't, worry quite as much. But, you just have to realize that things change as people change. And just because you have that ability to be in touch, 24/7, doesn't mean it's necessary. And sometimes it's even harmful.
So would you say for parents out there who might be going through this, who might be worried about it, that the ground does level off and you can get to a better place even though things change?
Right. Yeah, it absolutely does. And it's not just about communication. If you're children are leaving for the first time, it's your own loneliness sometimes that kind of takes over and makes you feel compelled to communicate with them. So maybe now what you need to do is start a new hobby or spend some more time with friends and other family to take place of having that loss really in your life.
Lori, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Lori Zierl is the family living educator for UW Extension Pierce County. She joined us to talk about how parents can optimize the way they communicate with their kids once the kids leave the nest.
Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll talk to baker extraordinaire Beatrice Ojikangas about her new book, Homemade, Finished Rye, Feed Sack Fashion, and Other Simple Ingredients for My Life and Food. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin started its recount of presidential votes yesterday. Today, super PACs that had supported Donald Trump filed a federal lawsuit to stop the Wisconsin recount. We'll get the details of this and other top Wisconsin news in our weekly roundup with Rob Menser.
First, it's Food Friday, and we're talking about how to create delicious food and community when you feel like hibernating this winter. Our next guest is the author of a cookbook called Soup Swap. Behind all the recipes is an idea to bring people together in a way that's creative and convenient by swapping soup.
Kathy Gunst joins us now. She's the resident chef of the NPR show Here and Now and a James Beard Award-winning food journalist. She's also the author of 15 cookbooks in addition to Soup Swap. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
So nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, walk us through the concept of a soup swap. How does it work?
Okay. Well, it's for me, personally, it started 6 years ago. I live in a small town in southern Maine, and a neighbor, a friend who loves to cook and eat, called and said, let's have a soup swap. And all I could hear was, uh-oh, another version of potluck. And I'm kind of fed up with potlucks. I don't know about you guys, but there are a lot of potlucks around here. And because I cook and think about food pretty much every waking minute. When you invite me to your house, I kind of want you to cook for me. So when she mentioned this idea, first of all, I said, I don't even know what a soup swap is, but is this just another potluck? And she said, no, here's the idea. We'll do it all winter long on the second Sunday of the month, all winter, and we'll go to a different person's home each time, and the host will make salad and bread and dessert, and then everybody brings a pot of soup, and we have a party, and then at the end of the night, and we all bring yogurt containers and mason jars, and at the end of the night, we go home with 6 or 8 or 10 leftover homemade soups instead of being stuck with that same old pot of soup all week. And I started doing the math, and I said, okay, so we cook once, but you go home with 6 or 8 or 10 meals? This sounds great. So 6 winters ago, we started doing this with a group of 12 friends and neighbors, and we're still doing it, and it has been a wonderful, wonderful way to make the winter a whole lot warmer, and it's just been fabulous. And, of course, the book came out of that whole experience.
And what kind of soups did you eat that first year?
Well, funny you should ask. The first year, the soups were, I don't want to be rude because people are going to think, oh, she's a food snob, but they were very basic. What you might eat, chicken noodle, tomato soup, kind of reminiscent of childhood soups. There were a lot of purees, you know, pureed squash soup, pureed zucchini soup, pureed bean soup, and they were good, and we loved them all. But what happened over the first year, and certainly by the second and third year, is that the soups became so much more sophisticated. The flavor profile was so heightened. It was as if people just, like, we had this focus all winter long. We had become soup makers. So we started basic, and then it seemed that each time we got together, people took a little bit more of a risk. They started making their own stock, or they started making Thai red curry soup, or a Russian borscht, or soups that are a little more involved and have a more interesting flavor profile. But the other thing that happened was that we, as a group, we were all friends of my neighbors. None of us were particularly very friendly with each other. We were kind of friends of friends. But by the second or third soup swap, something very clearly was happening. And for lack of a better word, it seemed that we were building community, that we were becoming really close, and we all so looked forward to those cold, snowy, soup-filled Sunday nights when we all got together. And it's really been an interesting process to see how making a pot of soup can actually build community.
We are making soup and building community with Kathy Gunst. Her new cookbook is called Soup Swap. This idea you can have, in addition to making soup, you can get a bunch of people together, make lots of different soups, share out the leftovers. You got a lot of different flavors to eat when you come home. Let's get to some soup making now, Kathy. You mentioned as people started to up their soup making games, some people started making their own stocks. And that's something I've played with. I make a lot of soup. I usually use something from the store to get that stock started.
Yeah, yeah.
Make the case for making our own stock.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked me that. This is one of my favorite cases to make. There is nothing wrong with using box stock. They've gotten a whole lot better than ones you find in the grocery store. I tend to tell people to look for low sodium or organic brands. But making your own stock, let me just break it down, okay? So let's start with chicken stock. Here's what's involved, people. Like, I think people imagine like a French chef with a tall white toque and a copper pot the size of, you know, a bathtub with bones, like, and whole animals coming out of it. But here's what it really is. You put a chicken in a pot. You throw in two carrots, two or three stalks of celery, an onion, a bay leaf, some peppercorn, and salt. And you just barely cover it with water. You bring it to a boil. You reduce it. You partially cover it, and you walk away for an hour and a half. So you go to a movie, you make a phone call, you do what you do on the computer, whatever your thing is. And an hour and a half later, you're going to come back, and you will not only have a gorgeous pot of stock, but you will have a fully cooked chicken, which you can then use in soups or stews or sandwiches or salads. You get two for the price of one. Another thing is that you can use what I call recycled foods. There's a lot of talk about food waste. It's something we all need to be conscious of. So what I do when I trim vegetables, let's say I'm cutting a leek and I'm trimming off the dark green part or the root stem, or I'm peeling an onion, or I'm peeling a carrot or a parsnip, I keep all of those peelings and I keep them in a bag in the refrigerator. And when I have a pretty large size bag, not weeks, we don't wait till it turns to compost, it's still fresh peelings, I put it in a strainer, I wash it all, and I throw it in a pot, and I do the same thing, barely cover it with water, add a full carrot, celery, onion, and I get this gorgeous vegetable stock from foods that I probably would have thrown away. The same is true after you've had your Thanksgiving turkey or a roast chicken. You can use the carcass to make a gorgeous stock. There is still a ton of flavor on it. So stocks are so much simpler than most people think. It's just become a scary word. I can't tell you why.
So let's say you made that homemade stock for the first time and you want to try out one of your recipes, chicken soup with noodles and matzo balls. This is just one or the other, isn't it? You're really going for it in this one.
Well, a lot of Jewish delis, I grew up outside of New York City. That was a big thing. They would do matzo balls and noodles. Mm. You could do one or the other. Matzo ball soup is classic Passover food, the spring Jewish holiday. But chicken noodle soup is... The Jews like to call it Jewish penicillin, but I'll tell you, it'll get you through any winter cold or flu or sore throat. It's what I turn to after the second sneeze or the first tickle in my throat all winter long. And again, you're making this chicken stock, and that's the base of it. And then you can strain out the vegetables and the chicken and add some fresh carrots and onion and celery, and then you can cook the noodles. This is really important for all soups where you add any kind of pasta or rice. You always want to cook it separately because what happens is if you throw raw rice or raw noodles into a chicken stock or any type of stock, when you cook pasta, as you know, it absorbs some water and it gets soft and it releases all this starch. And you don't really want that to happen in your soup. So you always want to cook the noodles separately and then add them. And then matzo balls are really fun to make. You get matzo meal and you add some chicken fat and egg. And my mother-in-law taught me if you add seltzer instead of water, they become very fluffy and light.
Huh. That sounds like a delicious one. Actually, that was just a revelation. We were all kind of nodding our heads when we were talking about cooking the noodles separately. I always wondered, why do I just have noodles and no more soup?
Well, exactly. I mean, I always make, so after Thanksgiving, I always take the turkey carcass and make a big pot of turkey stock. And then I love to make the Greek turkey lemon rice soup. So have turkey stock, and you can add rice or orzo and lemon and egg yolks. And it's this thick, comforting, wonderful soup. And I used to make it where I just threw the orzo into the pot because orzo seemed so little, like I could get away with it. And after an hour, my soup was this big mush because the orzo continues to drink all that delicious soup. So you want to drink it and not let your pasta drink it.
I've been there, too. We are talking to Kathy Gunst. By the way, we've got that recipe, the chicken noodle and matzo soup, and some other ones linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Kathy is a food journalist, author of the cookbook we're talking about, Soup Swap, comforting recipes to make and share.
And we want to hear from you on this. What kind of soups are you looking forward to as we get to the thick of winter? You can share your favorite recipes with us by calling 800-642-1234 or posting on the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what your favorite soup garnishes are. What kinds of things do you like on the side? And what about those homemade stocks? Do you do that? And do you feel like it's worth it? What's your favorite method for making a homemade stock? If you've got any questions, Kathy is right here to answer your soup questions. Our number, 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now, we're picking up the conversation with Kathy Gunst, James Beard award-winning food journalist and author of the new cookbook called Soup Swap, Comforting Recipes to Make and Share.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite soup to make? What is your favorite soup to eat when somebody else makes it for you? Do you have questions for Kathy, some advice, a soup that you want to make? It just doesn't go right when you try it. What is your favorite technique? Do you make your own stock? Call with all things soup related at 800-642-1234. And hey, have you ever done this idea? Everybody makes soup, comes over, eat some, swap out the rest, or would you do this with your friends, neighbors, family? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Kathy, I want to ask you, what is it about soup that makes the soup swap thing work, do you think? Because I can't imagine that there would be as much enthusiasm if it were a salad swap. I mean, I guess salads would be a little fun, but soup seems so much more
comforting. Well, maybe
on
July 4th it might be fun. I don't know. I think soup is probably the ultimate comfort food. If you think back to being a kid and having your mother, grandmother, whoever it was that helped you, you know, just serve you a bowl of soup, that's just the most comforting memory. And there's something about soup, I think the process of slowly letting flavors emerge and having this broth and adding vegetables or meat or fish to it, there's just something about that process, for me at least, that really grounds me. I mean, during the whole election, when I really thought that I was going to go out of my mind and I was so deeply unsettled by it, I just kept making soup every single day. And I did find it deeply comforting and somehow rooting and grounding. And there is just something about a pot of soup that makes people feel good. So sharing it with friends, neighbors, maybe it's your book club, maybe it's your yoga group, maybe it's a church or synagogue. It's a wonderful way to get people together. It's a food that almost everybody loves. And it's a really interesting way to learn about where people are from, where they grew up, what kind of things they grew up with, because hopefully some people will call in whenever I've been talking a lot around the country, and when I'm in live audiences, I always ask the audience, so if you were a soup, who would you be? And it's so interesting because almost always people tell these stories and they put their hand on their heart. And there's something about telling a story about soup or childhood or growing up. A lot of people have talked about, older people have talked about wartime and stretching a dollar or only having a few things in their larder, but that they made these beautiful soups. This is another wonderful thing about soup, is that there's no class boundaries to it. You can make a pot of soup from dried beans for a few pennies a serving, and you can make soup from lobster, and you could add cabbage. caviar and everything in between. And it's really interesting to hear people's stories. It's a very lovely way to bring people together.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nathaniel is with us in Eau Claire. Nathaniel, hi.
Hey there. Great show. I absolutely love what you guys are doing. I have two things. One is I'm actually a chef at a Japanese restaurant here in Eau Claire, and I can tell you that soup is one of the simplest and most complex things you can ever possibly imagine. It's very, very difficult to get it right, but, you know, you can always make something from the meagerest of ingredients. My second thing is that Gordon Ramsay actually has one of my favorite recipes I've ever made online. You can look it up, and it's a roasted tomato recipe for a soup, and it actually combines like a homemade pesto made from sun-dried tomatoes and Parmesan in addition to roasted vine tomatoes, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Yum.
Especially if you've got some extra vine tomatoes stocked up at home, and they're kind of starting to go bad because the riper they are, the better the soup. So definitely check it out. I recommend to everybody. It seems really complex, but it gives you a really good example about how you can make amazing, simple, cheap dishes at home, and Ramsay does a fantastic job of doing that.
Nathaniel, thanks for that recommendation for the roasted tomato soup. And he's at a Japanese restaurant. That reminds me that one of the recipes we've got of yours, Kathy, is a vegetable ramen in miso ginger broth.
Yeah, oh, that's so delicious. I loved what Nathaniel said about it being complex but very simple at the same time. That's actually a really profound thought because it really does succinctly tell the story of soup. It's not complex, and yet it can be so sophisticated. The ramen recipe that you've got uses late fall vegetables like butternut squash, and you could use anything. I use sunchokes or water chestnuts, mustard greens or spinach or spicy greens, and then the broth is quite simple. Speaking of Japanese flavors, it's a very simple miso broth with fresh ginger, and then you can add noodles to it at the end, and that's a whole dinner. That is a one bowl dinner that is so comforting and soothing and satisfying.
Thanks a lot for that call, and we go next to Jason in Sheboygan. Jason, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to share?
When I do my beef barley, I will run a 5-pound beef roast through the crock pot, then I'll save the broth, freeze it, and then run upwards of 15 to 20 pounds of beef through the same broth before turning it into soup. And that's just,
wow, that sounds fabulous.
Flavor amazingly. And then another thing I do with chili or spaghetti sauce is simmer it, and then at bedtime, take it off the heat, wrap it up in 2 or 3 bath towels, turn it back on in the morning while I'm getting ready to go to work, take it off, wrap it up again. It never gets below 150 or 160 degrees, and it essentially simmers for 2 days before eating it and putting it away, freezing it.
That's the best of slow cooking.
What do you think about that sort of really letting the flavors develop over a long period of time sort of method, Kathy?
Well, I think it can be really successful. I like to say that soup is like people at a party that don't know each other very well. So you're all in the room, you get a drink, you're getting to know each other, it's a little awkward, you know, you're all new to each other, and within an hour or two or three, you're really having a good time, and you're getting friendly, and you're mingling, and soup is a lot like that. It's always, almost always, better the next day. It really takes slow cooking to let those flavors develop. I do a beef barley mushroom soup in the book where I soak dried mushrooms and then I strain the liquid, which becomes this beautiful mushroom broth, and add that back to the soup just to build even more flavor.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jason. We're talking to Kathy Gunst, author of Soup Swap, Comforting Recipes to Make and Share. A lot of her soup recipes linked on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go next to Anne on the line in Green Bay. Anne, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share that the last several years, my husband makes up quarts upon quarts. I think we had like 86 quarts of canned soup that he's made. He makes his own stock, and we give them as Christmas presents to family and friends.
How lovely. What a wonderful husband. That sounds like such a great gift. I'm a big believer in food gifts.
And is it all the same flavor of soup or all different kinds of soup?
Nope, different kinds he'll make.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
What a great gift.
That sounds fantastic. Anne, thanks for that. And let's take another call, a brief call here from Carol in Sullivan. Carol, hi.
Hi. It's so funny you're talking about soup now because we have our cookie exchange on Sunday. And once a year, I make this beef cabbage oxtail soup.
Mm.
Oh, it is so good. I put some barley in it, the cabbage, carrots, celery, all the vegetables I can find. And right now I got my oxtails cooking in the slow cooker in a beef broth. And then I'll put it all together tomorrow and we'll exchange our cookies.
That's
how nice. I often tell.
Soup.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, it sounds like a well loved soup. Go ahead, Kathy.
I was just going to say that a lot of times when I'm trying to describe what this book, Soup Swap, is about, I say, think of a Christmas cookie swap, only healthier. So you've got both going. Boy, you've got some sophisticated listeners. Their cooking sounds so fabulous.
Well, Kathy, what are you going to make for your next soup swap?
Well, I'm not sure. One thing that I really love is I do a roasted carrot and ginger soup. And roasting carrots, because they're root vegetables, it brings out a lot of the sugars and the sweetness in the carrots. And we have a winter farmer's market, so I'm going to go there tomorrow and buy a whole bunch of locally grown carrots and roast them. And then this is a really cool trick. I add fresh ginger to the soup, but I also take a tea bag of ginger tea, which you can buy in any supermarket, and I make a very strong mug of ginger tea, and then I strain that ginger tea into the soup, and so that becomes like a flavored broth as well, and the ginger flavor is not only fresh in the soup, but then you have the ginger tea, and then I puree the whole thing, and I'll grate fresh ginger on top at the end, so you get ginger in three different ways.
Wow, that sounds
really
yummy.
Triple ginger soup, wow.
Triple ginger, yeah.
And the tea bag, I love that idea. I make carrot ginger soup too, but I did not roast the carrots or do the tea bag, so.
The tea bag is a revelation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so simple. It takes no effort, and you can't believe the way it pulls out that ginger flavor in the best of ways.
Kathy, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Kathy Gunst. She's the resident chef of the NPR show Here and Now, James Beard Award-winning food journalist. She's the author of 15 cookbooks, including Soup Swap, Comforting Recipes to Make and Share. You can see the recipes we talked about today and a bunch more of them, actually, that Kathy has provided for us. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page or check out today's Food Friday page. You can find that over at WPR.org.